Bob's Red Mill believes in baking, breakfast, and the pursuit of good food for all. Learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to The Line. On today's episode, I'm joined by Jake Dell, the owner of Katz's Delicatessen, the iconic Jewish deli located on the Lower East Side. Katz's opened in 1888. It was purchased by the Dell family in 1988 at its 100-year anniversary. Jake officially joined the business after, you know, obviously having spent many years probably running around the tables in 2009. He's now in charge of all major operations. He's expanded the shipping to include a national reach, which we'll talk about, and soon they will be opening Katz's second location, first outside of Manhattan, in the soon-to-be-opened DeKalb Market, which is sort of by the Barclays Center. He's got a BA from Tufts and an MBA from NYU Stern School of Business, and he was selected as a Forbes 30 Under 30. Today we're going to be talking about gentrification of New York City, pastrami, how a restaurant can remain relevant and busy after 129 years in business, and the rules, both spoken and unspoken, of deli culture. Jake, welcome to The Line.
Thanks for having me on.
Okay, full disclosure, let's get started. I grew up wearing a red Katz's Send a Salami to Your Boy in the Army t-shirt that I got on vacation. I imagine tons of people can tell you that because it's one of the major tourist destinations in New York City. It's a cultural landmark. Let's start by talking about deli tradition. What makes a deli great and allows Katz's to stay in business for 129 years?
Well, first I'll say I have that exact same shirt. I have about 85 different Katz's shirts. So I think there's a lot of things that make deli, deli. It's an old tradition, right? It's something that you saw a lot of in the late 1800s. It's an old tradition brought over from Eastern Europe and brought here. Unfortunately, over the years, a lot of them have disappeared. And it's you know, it's sad to see. It'd be sad. It's the same thing if all of a sudden every pizza place in New York disappeared or every bagel shop disappeared. It'd be a travesty. So what we do is we try and preserve that tradition, that food tradition for New Yorkers. And it's something that now tourists have kind of been drawn to for that same reason, because they recognize, hey, this is a very old New York tradition. It's something that when I look around, I see the classic New Yorkers. I see the sanitation guys and the Wall Street guys all chowing down on pastrami, and they're sitting side by side. And so I want to go there and I want to experience that and I want to learn about this food culture.
It's a rare thing to find in any major city, but especially in New York City, a place, not just restaurants, that's sort of heralded as a cultural institution that people visit, that also locals visit. You know, most people that live in New York, they're not going to Ellis Island and the Statue of Liberty, right? They're not doing the things that tourists do. But like you said, people are side by side at Katz's. I'm curious to know, how did your family get involved? Did you used to go to Katz's as a family, and then one day you were presented with the opportunity to purchase it? Who was first involved before you were old enough to take over? Were your parent, when it got purchased, were your parents the people that ran it day to day?
Right. So the Katz family had been involved for many years. It technically actually was the Iceland family first, and it was called Iceland Deli. And then it was called Iceland and Katz, and then Katz Deli. Or Katz's is how I say it. But, you know, a lot of people struggle with that apostrophe S.
Yeah,
and they're like, oh my God, what do I do?
So tricky, the Z and the S.
Yeah. So my grandfather became a partner with the Katz, original Katz family, with the second generation. He was kind of this self-made guy who grew up on the Lower East Side, ended up running and owning a bar. and then use that to become partners at Katz's. And it's a little misleading because what it is now is not what it used to be. Old world restaurants, transfer of ownership was not like, hey, listen, here's some money. It was, I want to buy this restaurant from you. It was like, here, you want to deal with these freaking bills? It's all yours. It's your headache. It's no longer my headache. Good luck. It wasn't like a glamorous, glorious thing. So my grandfather just grew up in the neighborhood and he loved the place and he didn't want to see it go. And my father and my uncle joined and my mother and my aunt helped out when they could. They were both teachers. But, it's a family business and times were really, really rough in the late 80s, early 90s. And so it was all hands on deck.
Yeah. So in the late 80s, I imagine that the Lower East Side, I mean, I know it didn't resemble
rough.
Anything what it resembled today.
Right.
What was the appeal for your father and your mother to get involved? Was it more like they just had to because it was the family thing, or did they have deli in the blood?
A combination of the two. My father was a manager at a different deli called Wolf's Deli, which was very popular back at the time in Midtown Deli. Did a lot of catering jobs and things like that. So he was kind of already in that deli mode, if you want to call it that. My mother was teaching around the corner at Seward Park High School, which is actually where my mother and father met. My father grew up on the Lower East Side there, too. So.
So they met at the high school that she then went on to teach at, basically, or in the Lower East Side?
It's the other way around. My father went to that high school and then later taught for a couple of years at that same high school where my mother then was teaching, and that's how they met.
So your family is deeply ingrained in the Lower East Side.
Very much so. My mother was a Brooklyn girl, and my father's a Lower East Side guy. And
did you grow up in the city? Where were you living with your family?
We were what's now called Kips Bay and now pretty cool, I guess, and trendy and, filled with the worst. We grew up right by the NYU hospital.
Okay.
So
what are some of your early memories of being a young kid and going and running around that cavernous space?
It was exactly that.
It's huge as an adult, right? It's huge when it's filled with people.
Imagine when you're five and six.
Yeah, what's it like when you've got like kind of free reign to run around and you're like the little cute mascot of Katz's Deli that everyone gets to like mess around with?
So it was a combination of the two. I definitely ran around and had a great time. But at that time, our customer base was a lot heavier on the old Jewish men and like old Russians and old, like just old guys. And when you're a little kid, those guys are scary as hell. Yeah. And I did not run behind the counter. My father would also scare the crap out of me. He would say, listen, those knives back there, like people have chopped their entire hand off. So be careful. Don't run back there. And as a 6-year-old, you're like, oh my God, I don't want to lose my hand.
Of course. So, there's those big, scary vats of boiling meat water.
Exactly. Oh no, the tanks are the size of this room that we're sitting in right now. And the whole, a couple thousand pounds of meat, and there's this, and there's smokers, and there, and so it's terrifying, but it's also the place I grew up in. And the truth is, when I was growing up, to me, it was just the store. You know what I mean? It was just the place my father went to every day, and it was the place that I got to go to, sometimes after school and sometimes on weekends. And when I got old enough, I got to hand out tickets, which was amazing, and I got to do some of the dirty jobs, which I enjoyed, and I just was there all the time, and I love it.
Do you remember a moment from your teen years or from your childhood when you thought to yourself, oh, this isn't just any old restaurant? Was there someone that visited? Was there a turning point in the 90s when you had a moment where you thought, oh, Katz's is a little bit bigger than my mom and my dad and my grandpa?
So it actually didn't happen to me until college, but that's also because I'm a bit of an idiot. So, and just did not pick up on these things. We had President Clinton in the store, and we had all these very well-known and famous actors and celebrities and musicians. And to me, I was like, well, whatever. That's like
New York.
They're just people. It's New York. There's famous people everywhere. It's New York. And then when I got to college, and similar to what you were saying, there's a guy wearing a Katz's shirt in the cafeteria. And I go over to him, and I was like, oh, cool, you're from New York. You know, where are you from? He's like, no, I'm from Louisville, Kentucky. I'm like, what? How the hell do you know? What? That's my family's what? That's when it kind of dawned on me.
It became much larger in a worldwide scope at that point, right?
Exactly.
So you're in college and you've kind of moved away slightly from the business, right? You were pursuing a medical professional career,
yeah.
And then you kind of got drawn back in, right? So around
the lure of the deli, exactly.
Around 2009, you take over and you return to New York. I'm curious about, you know, obviously you'd spent years and years in the family restaurant, but that is a different animal than being sort of the managing partner or the president. But so what level of preparedness did you feel when you took over in 2009? And I'm curious, you know, first off, what was the first thing to blindside you? Because it's a huge operation. And then after that, if you can talk about, like, how did you earn the respect of the staff? Because you've got some guys that are probably double, triple your age at that point.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And now you're not like, hey, little Jake, what's going on? You're home from college. You're their boss. So I'm curious about that whole transition process. How did that come to be?
Yeah. Wow. That question alone could be this entire show. It was certainly challenging. And as far as my preparedness, zero. There's nothing that can prepare you. All the school in the world, all the things that you think you know go right out the window the second the first angry customer comes up to you yelling that their pastrami was not perfect. And that's it. You know what I mean? And that's any service related job. You realize that people can be very demanding of your time, your effort, your energy, and you just have to roll with the punches. So that's on the job training. And within the first 6 months, I learned more than I did in my entire life. I do think it was wonderful that in retrospect, my father kind of helped train me a little bit all along. He would come home and ask the family questions, you know, hey, this customer did this today. What would you have done? And then we would talk about it. And as kind of like just casual dinner conversation. And so that actually kind of helped me once those real situations happened. As far as the staff goes, that took a while. I think I'm finally at a point where I think I had some semblance of respect. It's very, very challenging to walk into a situation and tell someone to do something when they remember you in diapers. You know, it's like, hey, I remember that time that you had an accident and crapped your pants or something, you know, like it's okay, cool, but I still need you to do that.
Yeah. You don't have much leverage over them at that point.
Really didn't. So it was just a matter of being there and putting in the hours and showing that I was willing to come in on overnights and willing to come in and do the dirty jobs and come in and handle those customers that no one else wanted to handle and appease them. And I think just by seeing that I was committed to the place and not just, you know, that, you know, the boss's son or boss's nephew or boss's grandson or whatever it may be. I think that by hopefully, I mean, I guess you have to ask my staff rather than asking me, but I think we're, you know, at a point where they hopefully respect me because I respect them and it's this kind of, it's just a growing relationship in it.
So let's spend a little time and give them sort of the respect that they deserve. Let's talk about the staff for a little bit. First off, how many people work at Katz's?
So I have some of the best staff in the world. I have 140 people right now.
Huge restaurant
yeah.
staff. So I want to know I want to know about the slicing process. But before we get to the slicing process, I want to know about how do you get trained at Katz's to reach that level? Because that's sort of that's the pinnacle, right?
Yes.
Once you're a cutter,
you've made it.
So right. Can you sort of summarize how someone who joins Katz's ends up being those amazing guys
yep.
that are cutting? And
years
how they
of abuse. you start on an overnight shift, and you start on the floor, and you start cleaning the bathrooms, and you start – just being in the restaurant. And, you know, then when you've demonstrated that and a willingness to be there and hardworking, it's something you can't teach. You can't teach, you know, an innate pride in your work. You can teach everything else. So then, you know, we put you on the soda station and sodas and fries. It's a pretty easy first step to dealing with customers. And then we put you over on the grill where you learn the hot dogs, you learn the knishes, you learn how to take care of food the right way, how to be clean while you work, how to take care of customers. And then kind of on your off hours, you know, we give you, you know, an hour or two to start slicing some bread, start slicing pickles, just to practice, you know, your hand-eye coordination, I guess, your skills with the knife. You know, if you picture a lot of people that are righties, they'll use their left hand to hold something while they cut it, right? Let's say you're cutting a cucumber, for example, and you kind of use your finger to help guide the top of the knife. Well, in this case, when you're cutting meat, you don't have that luxury. You're not using that left hand. You're using another utensil. So that's a skill you have to learn. And it's just years of practice. That's it. The cutters are so talented. They're artists. I mean, it's years and years of practice. I don't make a great-looking sandwich. I'm the first to admit it. I mean, when we do these photo shoots or things like that, I say, listen, I'll do it. I don't think that's a good idea. I mean, I'm not there behind the line every single day, every single shift, practicing and taking care of the meat and trimming the meat. And these guys are artists at what they do. I mean, it's not a skill that comes overnight. Mm-hmm. It's something that you hone over the years. And my God, these guys are just the most talented.
The speed is tremendous. So yeah. I know that you're going through about 30,000 pounds of
that's
meat
correct.
A day.
No, a week.
A week, sorry, yeah. Sorry. Still a ton. I mean, so how many sandwiches does a cutter make during like a busy lunch rush?
Hundreds.
Hundreds of sandwiches.
Yeah. My fastest guy can do, let's say, 70, 80 sandwiches in an hour. Over a sandwich a minute.
Is there competition between them? Like, who's the fastest? Do they know?
Or they
do
know.
They
everyone
all
knows
argue?
Who the fastest
Everybody
is.
Knows.
Everyone knows.
Okay.
You know, there's a little sliding scale of that.
Is there a hierarchy amongst the staff in terms of, like, the guys that have been there for you guys?
Oh,
you got guys that have been there, what, 20,
yeah.
30 years?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, seniority happens. And there's always going to be office politics, if you want to call it that. You know, there's always going to be that you know, well, I've been here longer and I know what I'm doing, so screw mm-hmm. you. And there's always those kind of interactions, which I happen to love. I find those fun.
I do want to ask you a little bit about politics, which is you've got 140 people that work for you. Many of them not from this country. They're not people that have maybe been in this country for long. And then you have people that have been in this country for dozens and dozens of years. Have you had an opportunity to have any conversations either with the group or offline about people that are worried in any way about the current political climate?
I think yes. Short answer is yes. I think overall, though, we're a family, and I think people know that we're going to look out for each other and we're going to take care of each other. And, you know, these guys have been with me for a very long time, my whole family for a very long time. And so we're going to look out for each other, you know, and any sort of politics that happen behind the scene, we don't let it carry over to the restaurant itself or to the service itself. It's the two my only things that I don't allow conversation behind the line of are politics and religion. That's it. That's it. Keep that shit outside.
anything else, you let them kind of jaw back and forth with customers a little
exactly.
bit. You want to give them a little bit of that New York-y
exactly.
experience
give
or whatever.
Give them an edge, but no, you know, don't go so far that you offend a customer. But.
Sure. And so when someone's coming into the restaurant, they think that most people that are sort of quote-unquote in the know, they know to order a sandwich fatty, right? They know that they should be getting that good awesome.
Or juicy. That's the secret word.
The secret word is juicy. Okay. I'm curious, in your opinion, and also in the opinion of the staff, what's the most underrated item at Katz's? I mean, everyone's coming for the pastrami and the corned beef.
Right.
That's what's bringing them in. But what do you feel is the thing that's never had its sort of day in the sun?
I have
shine?
A turkey a lot of the days.
Okay.
I think we have some of the best turkey that you're going to find. It's a Thanksgiving turkey, essentially. It's an all-white meat cooked in a bag of its own juices, so it's hot, it's tender, it's moist, it falls apart. And so for those people that don't eat a ton of red meat, it's such a game changer. I mean, it's wonderful. I objectively love it. Like, and not just saying that because it's my baby, but I mean, it's also the matzo ball soup I love. And the real winner are the latkes. I do some of the best latkes. Sounds really cocky, actually. I should tone that back a little bit. But they're really, really good.
It's okay. Your restaurant's been open for 129 years. I think you're allowed a little bit of leeway in how cocky you want to be. Most people are like, I hope I make it 2 years or 4 years.
It's a hard industry, especially in New York. It's very, very difficult.
In terms of, you know, you just mentioned latkes, matzo balls. You went, you know, you have obviously it's a Jewish deli, but you have a couple things on the menu that aren't a traditional Jewish deli item.
Like a grilled cheese.
And you've got a cheesesteak, right?
A cheesesteak, right.
So I'm curious, how much has your family had to kind of cater to things that people ask for that you as a deli guy says, I didn't really want to put on the menu, but people were coming in and asking for it. I own a business. It's a business decision.
Right.
Can you speak to that
of
a little
course.
Bit? How does that
yeah.
work? You know,
like the biggest travesty in the world is pastrami and mayo. I mean, that's
to
like
you. That's the biggest
offensive to me.
Okay.
But I'm still going to give you the mayo. I just like I'm not going to put it on the sandwich for you. Like you do that. I'm going to turn around.
Do it on the sandwich.
No. So yes, there's certainly every couple years we have to kind of tweak something, add something. The Reuben, for example, is not a traditional deli sandwich. I can't say this enough. And like that Arby's commercial, it's like the classic Reuben sandwich. You're like, no, but you don't understand the tradition of deli. But that's, again, that'll be a rant for a different day. So, right, the Reuben we added to the menu because we're like, well, listen, we have sauerkraut. I guess we'll add cheese to the menu. It's not that hard. We didn't have cheese for the first 70 years we were in business.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we can add cheese. Enough customers are asking for pastrami and Swiss or pastrami Swiss and sauerkraut. Okay, we can do that. Add a couple of years, it's like, listen, we already have the roast beef. We already have the cheese. All we need is peppers and onions. Well, we have onions. All right, fine. I guess we'll add a cheesesteak. It's a hard balance because you want to stay traditional and not change a single thing. But there's a tipping point, right? Enough customers ask me for the same thing, and I don't have a choice to do it. Like, for example, stuffed cabbage. We didn't have it on the menu for years. Then one day we added it on. It went crazy for a year, and then we never sold another one ever again. For the next, 7 years, we didn't sell a single freaking stuffed cabbage. I'm like, all right, well, I guess we're taking it back off the menu. So I think it's different. You know, most restaurants in New York have to change on a seasonal basis at the very least, right? They can't always have the same menu 24/7 for years and years and years. But we're in a lucky position where people want that tradition and they want the classics. Like you said, they come for the pastrami and the corned beef. Give them the pastrami and the corned beef.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And so it in many ways, it's very lucky to be able to be in that position.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with more Jake Dell talking about Katz's Deli on the Lower East Side. Stick with us.
I don't think there's anybody worthy to run this company but the people who built it. I have employees who've been with me for more than 30 years, and plus. Each and every one of them deserves to be an owner. That's just the way it ought to be, and that's just the way it is.
This is Bob Moore. He and his wife, Charlie, started Bob's Red Mill almost four decades ago.
Today, they offer one of the largest lines of organic whole grain foods in the country. And in 2010, on his 81st birthday, Bob gifted ownership of the company to his employees.
I'd received plenty of offers to buy my company over the years, but selling out never felt like the right thing to do. When the time comes to let someone else run this show, I can't imagine selling it to a stranger. Giving the company to my hardworking employees just feels right.
The company now has an employee stock ownership plan, or ESOP. Stock is put in a retirement plan for all of its employees. When employees retire, the company buys back their shares. According to the National Center for Employee Ownership, about 11,000 companies in the U.S. currently run as ESOPs.
It just shows how much faith and trust Bob has in us.
That's Bo Thomas, the company's engineer and maintenance superintendent. He's been with Bob's Red Mill for over 27 years and has put his four children through college in the process.
For all of us, it's more than just a job. And obviously, it's the same way for Bob, too.
Bob is still very active in the company. He's the president and CEO, and you'll find him working at the mill just about every day. Because when you love something this much, you want to be a part of it.
Well, I may have given them the company, but the boss part is still mine.
Bob's Red Mill is committed to sharing only the freshest, best-tasting whole grain foods on the planet. Learn more about their mission of good food for all at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
Welcome back to The Line. My guest today is Jake Dell. He's the owner of Katz's Deli, located in Manhattan. We've been talking a lot about tradition in the first half of the show and sort of reconciling keeping things just the way that they've always been for 129 years, but also being malleable in the sense of adding certain things to the menu and processes to make things slightly more modern. They still have a ticket system that they use at Katz's, which is just you get a ticket at the door and then the cutter marks it off and at the end you pay for it. I want to talk about now going super modern, which is the first outpost of Katz's. Maybe there will be more. We'll talk about that in a second. But tell me about how you decided to get involved in DeKalb Market. What is Katz's Brooklyn going to look like? And how different or similar will the experience be?
So it is definitely challenging to go from something very traditional to doing something new, especially, you know, there's this weird dynamic where customers don't want me to change anything, but they also want it everywhere. You know what I mean? And so a lot of what I do is about maintaining the experience and making sure you have the classic experience, but bringing it a little bit closer to you. So that's why we've expanded shipping all over the country to bring Katz's a little bit closer to you, to do catering, to bring it a little bit closer to your office. And now with Brooklyn, it's the exact same concept. It's a small, small takeout only, 400 square feet, in the middle of a crazy busy food hall, just chaotic in the center of downtown Brooklyn, where there's a lot of people and a lot of my customers come from or live or work. And it's about bringing the food just a little bit closer to them. And if the only experience they've ever known is taking out from Katz's, not sitting in, but take out, and there are many, many customers like that, then this is the exact same experience. I'm losing touch with a lot of those customers, with a lot of the classic Brooklyn or Queens or Long Island, the crowd that drives in, parks outside, runs in, grabs a sandwich, and drives home. And brings this home sandwich for, you know, wife and kids, you know. And unfortunately, it's getting harder and harder to do that on the Lower East Side. Just parking is difficult. And everything's difficult in the Lower East Side. And it's crowded and it's busy. It's chaotic. So hopefully Brooklyn will allow that to happen. It'll allow that connection with the customers that have kept me in business for so long. You cannot forget about about your customer base and about your loyal fans. And you have to do something for them every once in a while, every 129 years.
I'm curious, are you going to bring any cutters over? Are you going to use a POS system? Like, how different is it going to be? You know, it's in a fancy food hall, let's be honest, which is in a big fancy mall. So how are you going to try to keep that, besides the flavors and besides, you know, the menu, how are you going to try to keep it?
So the first thing is the food, as you just said. I mean, that's the most important thing.
Right.
If the food's even a little bit off, I will hear about it. They will yell at me and they will castrate me. So there's no question. We're still going to make everything ourselves, cure everything, smoke everything in the store and just bring it over. It's just easier. How do we do beyond the food? It's the look. It's the feel. We're very... I'm working with I hired an art director now. I'm promoted someone from within who I'm working with very closely to make sure it maintains that feel.
Yeah.
Which is very challenging and sounds like a super fluffy answer, but I don't know how to articulate it, quite frankly. It's just something that I know is going to be right. You know, I've lived and breathed cats as my entire life, so I'm going to make sure that it is cats's.
No disrespect to your parents and the folks that ran it before you, but it seems like you have a much more grand vision for Katz's than what may have existed 50 years ago. You're trying to take it in a larger, more expansive direction. I'm curious, do you have a specific growth strategy for the next 20 years for Katz's, or are you still going year by year as you're getting your feet underneath you with this massive operation?
So I don't think I have a 5-year, a 10-year, I even have a 50-year plan, and I don't know that there's many people that are as neurotic as I am on that front, but it's so flexible. I mean, it's so dependent on what happens, and you could plan up the ass, but when push comes to shove, I'm sorry, am I allowed to curse?
Yeah, okay. You can curse a ton. Don't worry about it. We're on the internet. You can do whatever you want.
You know how hard it was, by the way, as a New Yorker to, like, that was the first curse 32 minutes in. That's impressive.
We got time. You can let loose for the rest of the show.
I'll still be good. Now I don't even remember what I was saying. Right. So, you could plan, but at the end of the day, things happen on a weekly, daily, hourly basis. You know, right now, I just saw a text already. There's something, you know, something going wrong. That's just the nature of the business.
Yeah.
And so I do have a plan. I wouldn't say it's a grand vision. And I think there's I'm afforded a lot of luxuries that my parents and my grandparents didn't have. Which is that more people know about Katz's now too. I mean, and the internet and shows like this and Food Network and Travel Channel, hell, even Instagram. I mean, it allows for a wider reach, and now people are intrigued about this place that they weren't in the 60s, 70s, 80s. You know, so we're in a very different position today in 2017 than we were in 1987, you know?
It used to just be there was 3 movies that people saw that they knew about Katz's, but now there's hundreds of different touch points all over the world.
Exactly.
and on so many different channels that they can find you. Do you have a social media person? Do you do it yourself?
Yeah, well, so one of the waitresses, I was looking at some of the pictures she was taking. I was like, wow, you are really talented. You're really very good at this. Just start taking pictures and start posting them. And she started doing that. And we're up to, I don't know, 30-some-odd thousand followers. It's great. It's like pure food porn.
So you have someone that just was working there.
I have incredibly talented people around me. And it's just a matter of finding them. My art director now was a waiter. My, you know, like the people that I surround myself with started in the business because I know them, you know what I mean? And they know me and they know the store. And so I like that. I like that they're there and they're part of it. And it's not like they're, you know, they're still, she's still a waitress there. She's still a hostess, and she's, you know.
She's just doing a little more.
Yeah, exactly.
I want to ask you about something that was in the news a couple years ago now, I believe, which is the air rights. That sounds unbelievably confusing to me. And people that listen to this show that are in the biz, that pay attention to business in general, this is not something that you see all the time. So yeah. Can you explain a little bit about what air rights is, and also how did that kind of come about that that you negotiated that deal, and how
right.
difficult was that for you to navigate those waters?
Air rights are this incredibly novel concept that really don't exist much outside of New York in the same way. The idea is you're allowed to build up to a certain height, and in my case, I don't want to build higher. I'm happy being a one-story building, but the guy next to me, who was going to build a big building, the building was about to sell, he would very much like to put an extra 4 or 5 stories. You know, so we're not talking skyscrapers here. We're talking going from a, you know, 5-6 story building to a 10-11 story building. But for him, it's very valuable. And for me, I don't really care. So I can do this and essentially like building blocks. You know what I mean? Hey, listen, here are my imaginary 4 stories to put on top of your building. Don't touch my building. Stay away from my building. Don't build on top of me. It was very important for me to do that, to be able to fund some of these other amazing projects. I put it all back in the business to protect Katz's for the future. You know, it protects it physically, the building. Financially, it protects it. It just was a no-brainer. And it was, yeah, of course it was challenging. I learned a lot about the real estate business. You know, you do research and I, you know.
Who do you look for support in that realm, though? I mean, obviously, you've got 140 employees. You got thousands of customers coming through the door. Your day is busy. So, like, who do you look to for advice in the realm of large business decisions? Are any other family members involved in day-to-day decision-making processes? Or is it really you now?
It is. It's both. It's me, ultimately. But I still talk to my father and my uncle and I just get their thoughts and want to hear, because they have years, decades of experience. And you can't just throw that away. You can't just ignore that. So I like to hear what they have to say, and they often have a lot to say. It's a Jewish family. What do you want? Get their opinions and ultimately I don't know. I just try and surround myself with smart people. So I try and hire a good attorney or a good real estate person and let them hopefully guide me correctly and do my own research, you know?
You wrote a letter to the New York Times about Carnegie Deli closing, where you very eloquently pointed out that even though they were, in essence, sort of a competitor of yours, that they are really still part of the deli family, and that their disappearance was a negative occurrence in the city of New York. Can you just expand, for those that haven't seen the letter, can you just expand a little bit on how you felt when Carnegie closed and why? What prompted you to write the letter?
It's a travesty, honestly. I think – sorry, excuse me. Carnegie, for those that don't know, Carnegie Deli is very old, similar in style, the classic – big sandwiches, pastrami, corned beef, things like that. So in people's minds, especially tourists' minds, it was a strong competition. But it's really not. It's like a big brother, little brother type of relationship, because at the end of the day, you know, when people talk about deli, the more that they talk about deli, the better it is for everyone. There's more than enough business to go around. There's more than enough to share with people. And so it wasn't like... You know, they would call me up sometimes. Sandy would call up, and when he still ran it, I would call up my father and my grandfather and say, hey, listen, you know, we're short on bread this week. We're short on some pickles. Can you spot us some? And then, you know, when the weekend's done, when I get our next delivery, we'll give back. Of course. Of course there's that kind of camaraderie because we're all doing the same thing, the same tradition. And so, you know, as a Delhi man, it's very sad to see. As a New Yorker, it's even worse to see. Well, I don't know if it's worse. It's equally bad because it's a food tradition, a cultural tradition that is largely dying. And I don't want to be the only one. I don't. So it's sad. It's very sad. I felt the need to write something and send it out to someone to let someone read it. And otherwise, it's just me yelling to myself in the corner of a room.
Before we went live, you were saying that, you know, you eat a lot of meat, you're tasting the meat, you're looking at the product. I want to know specifically how do you know when the meat is ready? Can you talk a little bit about, you said that basically what you said is you've seen sandwiches go by you in the dining room before and you know by looking at it that it's not right.
Yes.
So how do you know? And what is the perfect meat sandwich then? When does it reach that level?
So the first thing that you notice is the smell. I guess let's start with the negative and then go to the positive. The negative, something's not right. It doesn't smell right. It doesn't look right. The fat doesn't jiggle quite right. You know, the way that it cuts is not quite right. And typically, it starts at the kitchen. The guy in the kitchen knows. When he takes it out of the pot, he goes, not 100% sure. And as it's going by, everyone's looking at it and going, oh, I'm not sure. And then it gets the cutters and they take it out and they start to cut it. And they're like, oh, I'm not so sure. All of my staff we work with this every day, every hour, every minute. And so we know when something's wrong. It's the same way that you know, if you have a kid and you know that you're like, that kid's about to get a cold. Something's about to happen. Or that kid's about to poop their pants or something. You know what's about to happen. It's the same way. It's the exact same type of relationship because you're so there. Present with that meat, and you see it every day. Now, as far as the perfect sandwich, it's the exact same thing, but in reverse. It's every single sense in your body. You smell it first. Well, I guess you look at the sandwich first. You see it coming off, and your eyes get wide, and then that you get that whiff of a little bit of garlic and a little bit of onion. Coriander and it all kind of hits your nose and goes towards the back of your sinus and you just sort of like stop for a second and you take a taste of it and it hits the front of the taste buds and it's one flavor and it goes to the back of the taste buds and it's another flavor and then you swallow it and you kind of have this orgasmic moment and you're like don't know what's up and what's down and that is a perfect pastrami sandwich. You want it with, for me, just a little bit of mustard on rye and that's it. I don't want anything else on it. I don't want Swiss. I don't want sauerkraut. I don't care. I mean, and you're welcome to do that. And I'll, sure. Yeah, no problem. That's not what I want. But I think everyone has their own special relationship with pastrami too. So, yeah. Damn, I just got hungry thinking about that, right?
Yeah. I think that you made everyone really hungry. Thank you for joining us today on the line. Everyone, go and check out Katz. As if for some crazy reason you've never been, I promise you, believe the hype. It's really, really good. 129 years in. Good luck on the Brooklyn location. We'll be keeping an eye on that and seeing how that goes. And we hope to have you back soon on the program. Thanks for making us all starving. Join us every Tuesday at 11 a.m. here on the line for more stories from chefs and restaurateurs.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.